Okay, well, let's begin. We're in Isaiah 25, is that correct? Are we approximately in the same place? This is a Sunday of feasting. We'll get to the gospel. I didn't look it up. Is that the marriage feast parable? And of course, this is this great text on the mountain, a feast on the top of the mountain in Isaiah 25. I'm not sure why it occurs in the lectionary at this point, other than it's a nice parallel to the Matthew text. And we've been sort of reading through that stuff in Matthew. As you know, the OTs are kind of picked ad hoc to go with the Gospels. Reminds us, too, that Jesus' talk about the so-called messianic banquet is not something new, that this idea of communion or table fellowship, whether that be particularly messianic, or the other tie-in, of course, is the Passover meal, both of which kind of get twisted together in Lord's Supper stuff, is very much part of the fabric of the Old Testament. Here in Isaiah, you've got this feast, it's in the middle of Isaiah 24 to 27, the so-called little apocalypse in Isaiah, which is a significant subsection of the book of Isaiah, really expanding the law gospel motifs on sort of a global, if not cosmic, scale. Hence the title, Little Apocalypse, here in 24 to 27. And somewhat in the middle of all of this, which is essentially a lot of law. I mean, Isaiah is pretty much blasting everybody now. In the Gentile oracles, which go from 13 to 23, he sort of blasts the specific nations one by one, starting with Babylon, chapter 13. But then when we get to 24 and 27, he kind of throws them all in one big heap and blasts everything, see? And it's sort of the whole world now is under God's judgment. Though there are specific references, for example, the section after this deals with the dung of Moab, and you have that really icky section where you come down from this mountaintop experience and you're literally back in the dung heap or soup with people swimming in some rather undesirable stuff, some of it lost in euphemistic translation. But what you have here right in the middle, and that's what I'm trying to set up, is sort of this mountaintop experience on Mount Zion. Presumably this is Zion. 6, by the way, this is also the Old Testament lesson. That was my reference to the lectionary for Easter, where the setting of the feast, it becomes there the Feast of Victory, which, by the way, we sing liturgically, if you use that canticle. And relates also to the section in here about death being swallowed up in victory. Okay. Va'asa Yahweh Tzivaoth l'kol ha'amim bahar hazeh mishte shimanim. And Yahweh will, presuming this is while consecutive, will do, simply asa, will provide, will make. Yahweh Tzivaoth will make l'kol ha'amim, for all of the amim. Now remember, that's the plural of am, and am means people as a collective singular group. So the amims is peoples, put an S on it. Now it sounds funny in English, all right? But people is singular, as in the people Israel or the people Moab. This is, for all practical purposes, a synonym for goyim, the nations. It means everybody, all peoples of every language, tribe, and tongue, as John would say in Revelation. Yahweh will make for all the amims, bahar hazeh, on the mountain, on this mountain. Which mountain, by the way? I mean, it's unidentified here. I mean, if you've been paying attention to Isaiah, this is certainly the same mountain you have in chapter 2, where the nations and the goyim flow, oddly enough, uphill to Zion, because from there the Devar Yahweh Yatzaz goes out, goes forth from Zion. So you have this kind of coming together on the mountaintop. Though interesting here, it's not identified. I mean, one is tempted to suggest that the locating of, at one and the same time, it's located in space and time on a mountain, but the mountain has begun to lose its specificity, see? Almost in anticipation of the fact that now Mount Zion is located in space and time, but is wherever God's people gather around the body of Christ, and doesn't have to be in a hill in Jerusalem in the Middle East, something like that. But you still have this mountaintop. You know, in church architecture, people need to remember this. Why is it, after all, that the altar is usually up a few steps, see? We probably don't pay a whole lot of attention to that. People just kind of think of that as going up to the altar, but it's almost symbolic of the mountaintop, see, in a very small way, perhaps. What will he do? A Mishte Shemanim, a feast of fatness. Huh? Mishte is from the verb shata, which you need to remember is really the verb for drink. So the word banquet is really off the word for drink, which probably describes what was dominant at their banquets. A feast of oily stuff. Shemen is oil. Or grease. Yeah, really, grease. Mishte Shemarim, a banquet of guarded stuff, shamar, of, this is probably preserved wine, a fat things that are, you want to parse mimukayim. Makah really means to be fat again, or shmiri. It's passive. I think this refers to fat things that are smeared all over your face, kind of like how you look after you've chewed the marrow out of a bone. All right? Which, if you enjoy that sort of thing, you know that's kind of the height of cholesterol pleasure, right? Now, in our idiom, I mean, you could probably say this is a great banquet, kind of surf and turf with a truck and Baron Auslaser or something like that. This is pretty good stuff. Remember, too, that these people, by and large, ate meat maybe three times a year in their society. Okay, so to have something described, and when they ate meat, my guess is they licked the bones pretty clean, right? And it's very descriptive of that. Of preserved wine, if that's what Shemar refers to, mizukakayim. Zakak means to filter, another pu'al participle, filtered or strained. Okay, Dr. Veltz would know this. I understand that proper enjoyment of truly good wine is always decanted through a, what do you call that, cheesecloth or some kind of thing. It's sort of a way of getting the last little sediment out of it before you drink. Yeah. So they probably knew about, you sort of filtered this stuff out. All right, 7. Ubala Bahar Hazat. What's the subject of Bala? It's got to be the only noun that's been a subject so far, and probably is the only candidate here, is Yahweh Tzavoth. He will swallow up on this mountain the penei, the face of the covering, or the veil, whatever this lot is, covering. It's repeated, the veil upon all the amim, the nations, and the ma-sa-seka, the covering, which is nisuka, a woven, kal passive participle, upon all the goyim. Now, a couple of things here. First of all, note the parallel between amim and goyim, simply confirming what I suggested before. Interesting for interpretation that we have this great big feast, but the first activity is Yahweh's eating something. Get it? We got this great big feast, and what gets swallowed? Well, Yahweh swallows, and what is he eating up? This veil, whatever that is, this covering. And as last point, what is the covering? Well, this is again kind of cryptic. Is this the so-called sort of veil of ignorance? My guess is this is the sort of funeral veil, if there would be what we today call a pall, but some sort of a covering that was associated with death, since that's the context here. Yeah. No, it's wrong word. Wrong. I think if he wanted to say that, it would be much clearer that that's what he's talking about. This isn't the veil of temple. Though it's interesting that that's part of what goes on in Good Friday and Easter, I suppose, but I don't think that's the point here. Verse 8, again, Bala, he will swallow up, and see, now it's almost identified. This is almost, you'll notice this is sort of printed in somewhere between poetry and narrative style. You've got some lines ending before the left margin, but it really is, looks like much more narrative. And I think even if this is narrative, which I doubt, you have repetition of thought similar to poetic parallelism. He has swallowed up the lot, now he has swallowed up, and now lot is kind of identified, what it is we're talking about here. He will swallow up Hamawath, the death. The article is interesting, right? Mawath means death, this is kind of the death. death with a capital D. Death as a concept, as a principle, not just individual specific deaths, but the whole darn concept of death, see? Netzach, forever. Netzach is almost a parallel to Olam. And Macha Adonai Yahweh, and Yahweh will wipe away. This is a Macha again. He will wipe away the Dim'ah Me'al Ka Panim. The Dim'ah. Dama really means to, these are tears coming out of your eyes. But it's a noun. We don't have a good English equivalent to sort of the concept of tear stuff. I'd like to say a tearness or something like that. You almost just have to use the plural tears. Tears from upon all faces. Me'al kol panim, from upon all faces. And the kherpath amo, kherpath is a significant word, it's construct, kherpah would be the absolute, and the reproach of his people, kherpah, reproach, shame, okay? A good little word study here, let me give you one thought. The shame of his people is essentially the fact that, put in sort of man on the street terms, their God didn't do them any good. What good is God if you have to live under a theology of the cross after all? See? What good is God if his people are poor and not leaders in the world? Huh? I mean, this sort of speaks to the cash value of religion, which is at the heart of every good American after all. If it doesn't do me any personal good, why bother with it? And in the Old Testament, of course, this was the shame of having a God who left you in exile, for example. Huh? Or a God who didn't make your country the most powerful empire in the world. See? And what good is your God? Here it's related to death. What good is your God if in the end you die? See? You spend all your life worrying about having the right God so that you can live in eternity, and what happens? You die. You know, and it's sort of the scoffing of people coming around and saying, what good is that God? So the reproach of his people, and how does God take away the reproach? Well, he takes away death, see, and trumps it. From upon all the, Yasir me'al ha'aretz. Yasir from Sur, Hifil, right? He will cause to go away, turn aside. And the reproach of his people, he will turn aside from upon all the earth, ki Yahweh deber, for Yahweh has spoken. It's always interesting. That's really the end of this little section. Ki Yahweh deber is closure. But verse 9 is always included, and with good reason, because it's kind of is the clinching line here. Va'amar, and who will say? Yahweh will say? No, it can't be Yahweh anymore. Here, there's no subject. It's probably indefinite. You'll notice at least the Qumran manuscript has its second person, Amarta. You will say, you could leave it as impersonal third, someone will say, i.e. anyone will say, i.e. everyone will say, Bayom Hahu, in the day of that one, Hine Eloheinu Ze. Wow. It's been my life's dream. Sometime I'd like to write a sort of a dogmatic exegetical theology called Hine Eloheinu, behold our God. In a sense, it says it all. Not just look at him, but here he is in sort of the here and nowness that Hine assumes. Behold, here is our, or behold, this is our God. Kiwinu, we have expected him. Kawa. Hope is too weak. Expect is a little stronger. That's what kawa really means. It's not a question of if, it's only a question of when. All right? There's a difference. It's not just, gee, it'd be nice if God would actually vindicate us, but who knows? It's expectation, right? We have expected for him v'yoshienu, hifil of yashah, while consecutive, no. It's not while consecutive. This is pure future. You could take this as a purpose clause. This is our God. We have waited, expected him so that he might save us. Usually that's with an imperative or cohortative. I'd like to take this as a just a great gospel indicative. Pure and simple. No while consecutive. No nothing. It's future indicative. We have expected him and he will save us. Ze Yahweh, this is Yahweh. Yahweh parallel to Eloheinu, now filling in a few details. Kiwinu lo, we have expected him. Let us, now you get cohortatives, let us rejoice Nagila, as in the Jewish song even today, Hava Nagila. Nagila, cohortative of Gil, let us rejoice, and let us samak, let us rejoice again, be Yeshuatho, in his Yeshua. Now you can take that as the noun, in his salvation. I'm almost tempted to leave it a little transliterated. Let us rejoice in his Yeshua, and let the reader understand. Okay, five after, we got to quit. Any quick questions? Jim, are you doing, or Vilsen, who's doing Greek here, or am I doing it?
Robbie did it.
Yeah, I understand it. Gibbs stiffed Robbie. Yeah, I understand. He did a great job. Ice cold? Yeah.
I can assure you, Wilson can do it cold better than I can do it cold.
Yeah. No, there isn't. I mean, it would be nice, but if you're going to do half of verse 10, then why not do the other half, which really starts taking a left turn into the dumpster. And I've always been bothered by the addition of verse 9. I mean, I think you should argue. You see the pay at the end of verse 8? That's a parashoth marker, which says that's at least a break in the text. But 9 gets I don't have an answer to your question, but I think it's a question you got to wrestle with a little bit. If you're going to do 9, why not do 10? If you're going to do 10, why not do all of 10? Is there a sense in which 9 and 10 is the transition now from something good to something bad and connects on to what follows it? I don't know. I mean, that's the nice thing about the lectionary is you can really just kind of pick and choose where you want to stop. See? And you raise sort of a good methodological question. Is that authorial intent insofar as we could even guess that? I know Belts can comment on that. But, certainly the books were not written to be read necessarily in the chunks that the lectionary has selected. And at least you got to be aware of that. Don't be naive about it. Okay.